Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute at the Gallipoli Club, for which we're very grateful for providing this access to us. And tonight we have a discussion on industrial relations down under, where to from here. And we have two people who are very experienced in Australian industrial relations over the last three decades or so. We'll start off with Judith Sloan, who's been involved in this debate for some years and has many positions. She's an author and has been an academic, but she's currently a contributing economics editor to The Australian. And Mark Lennon, who for the last two decades has been Secretary of Unions New South Wales. So we'll lead off with Professor Sloan. We'll go to Mark Lennon, and we'll have questions discussion. Judith Sloan, thank you.
Thanks very much, Jared. I like you saying that I've been interested in this for a few years, because it's probably decades, as a matter of fact. I think probably I became very interested in this, although I actually was interested in it as an undergraduate when I moved to Flinders University and worked for the National Institute of Labour Studies under Dick Blandy. And we, I think, as they might say, we punched above our weight. There we were, a small research group at a small university in South Australia. But we were one of the first groups of academics that was proposing that we shift away from the highly centralised system of compulsory arbitration towards enterprise bargaining. Now, it kind of doesn't sound such a radical proposition, does it? But in those days, it was a very, very unpopular thing to say. And I think it required a high degree of courage, both on part of Dick and the people he led in that group. So I look back at that time, I think with a high degree of professional pleasure, but there were certainly some rather hair-raising times in terms of being targeted. So what I'm going to do is just outline what I think is kind of it's kind of an interesting issue, and I don't know what people in the audience think, but I mean, industrial relations down under is very unique. It's still really very different from how these arrangements are established in an institutional sense compared with other countries. But I kind of get the impression that some people don't think it's important anymore, and I guess I'm going to try and make the case to say that it is still very important. Now, I guess Mark will say it's important too, because otherwise he wouldn't be in his job. But maybe he'll have a slightly different take on why it is important. I guess one of the reasons why economists might say it's not particularly important at the moment is that we have extremely low wage growth. So, you know, remember we had all those debates in the 70s, 80s and even into the 90s about, you know, how did we control wages breakouts and the like. So actually, if we look at the wage growth figures, they're pretty much as low as they've ever been in recorded history. So that, I think, is something interesting to think about. We also have very low rates of industrial disputation. So, you know, we used to have lots of strikes and short strikes, but longer strikes, big strikes, you know, going back and right through into the 80s, it started to fall off. And now we have a very low rate of industrial disputation. I might add that that is something that is basically a worldwide phenomenon. There really are no developed economies anywhere where there are high rates of industrial disputation. Unemployment, okay, I mean, to my mind, 6% is too high. Youth unemployment, too high, and I'll come back to that. But, you know, at 6%, it ain't 11% as it was in the early 1990s. So, you know, I think that's something we can think about. And I think a lot of people wouldn't attribute the unemployment rate to anything that goes on in industrial relations, although I would contend that there is a big link there. I guess the other reason people think industrial relations is irrelevant is that unionisation, the proportion of workers who belong to unions is now down to 17% overall. Once upon a time, it was over 50%. The rate of decline has been very rapid. And if we look at private sector unionisation, that figure is about 13%. But actually, and we were talking about this before, Mark, about if we look at public sector unionisation, it's more like 40%, but it's very much a nurses, teachers, AMBOs, FIREs. I think everything's not completely rosy on the macro front. The productivity figures continue to lag badly. There was a bit of a kick up in 2010-2011, but it's now kind of fallen in a heap. And we have to remember that what's happening now, because of the end of the mining boom, that gross national income, net national income, particularly per capita, is beginning to fall. And the only way forward really now to increase living standards is through productivity. So I think that is a really important way to frame the debate about why industrial relations is important. But I think I got to the point, mind you got rid of this fellow, didn't you, Tim Lyons? At, you know, they do that in Newman, the ACTU. I think he wanted to become the secretary, but no one else wanted him, so he's now gone. But we came to an agreement that in many ways the macro story is a lot less interesting than the micro story. So, and this is the point I'm wanting to make, is that when we think about industrial relations, what's important for large businesses is not the same as what's important for small businesses. And what's important in some sectors, in tourism or higher education or manufacturing, is not the same as in other sectors. So, and indeed, what's important in the public sector is not necessarily the same as what's important in the private sector. So when we think about the debate, is industrial relations important? Yes, it is. But the issues, the more specific issues, are actually quite variable depending on what you're talking about. So, you know, if you think about the small business world, unions are by and large irrelevant, right? So, you know, there are some small exceptions, say, with the subcontractors in the building industry and the like, where the unions are important. But in many, many areas, the unions are irrelevant as far as small businesses are concerned. But for many small businesses, the issue of penalty rates is very, very important. It was, I thought, very pleasing to see another former colleague of yours, Martin Ferguson, today, talk about the importance of penalty rates in tourism. You know, tourism's a 24/7 activity. If we're going to flourish in what is a highly competitive international environment, it's really important that we think about penalty rates. And we need to also think about penalty rates because the era of, you know, dad going off to work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and mum at home, young people leaving school and going into full-time work, that's all gone. And we have, I think, a very fluid labour market where there are lots of people for whom out of standard hours is actually what suits them. And so I think, you know, this debate has not gone well, but I think it's very important. Let me just get on to the Fair Work Commission, which, of course, makes Australia very unique. If we look overseas, there are often government-run endpoint dispute resolution institutions, arbitral institutions. But the Fair Work Commission is completely different from that. I mean, the Fair Work Commission is establishing, for example, modern awards. So I love the term modern awards, by the way, because, I mean, I don't know how an award could be modern, but there we go. There are 122 modern awards, and the key about them is that they set the floor, right? So they set the floor above which bargaining occurs. Well, sometimes the AWU ignores that, but generally speaking, in order for an enterprise bargain agreement to be certified by the Fair Work Commission, it would have to be at least as good as the award. You know, what happened with the awards was, and I don't know where you sit on this, Gerald, because I think this was a very big mistake about Work Choices, and there were a number of mistakes. But one of the things that Work Choices did was to create a national system. You know, now I know, you know, ACCI and the like, they all wanted a national system. I actually am a great federalist and believe that we've lost a tremendous scope for flexibility by getting rid of the state systems. But so what happened was that there was probably 3,000 to 4,000 awards. They've all been kind of, you know, head-butted together to create 122 modern awards. And it's been a case of the highest common denominator. So they've all floated up to the highest common denominators. So when you think about some of the tourist operators, for example, in Queensland squealing, the sort of backstory to this is that, like most of those Queensland awards, had either no or very, very low penalty rates. But what's happened to them over time is that they have now been forced into coverage by the modern award, which sets much higher penalty rates. So businesses have been set up on the basis of a certain business model. The industrial relations environment has changed, and it's created real tensions. Of course, Fair Work Commission is a kind of a retirement village for ex-union officials, by and large. Well, it is. You can go and have a look. They occasionally get a token lawyer or a token rep from an employer association, but, you know, there's a disproportionate number of ex-union officials as members of the Fair Work Commission. And they come up with some really strange decisions from time to time. And I guess, you know, that's likely to be the case. And, you know, by and large, that from time to time you see a decision, you think that's reasonably sensible, and then you come up with a decision and you think that's really weird. But the bottom line is that, in a sense, we shouldn't be going to a third party to be making these decisions at all. These are the kinds of things that should be left to the actual parties to the employment relationship between the workers and between the bosses, and maybe if the workers voluntarily want to be represented by the union or other bargaining agent, that should be fine. Of course, it's been exciting with the Royal Commission into Union Governance and Corruption. I guess you've enjoyed it, Mark. Yeah, sorry. And, you know, look, I think the big picture is this, that, you know, it's, and, you know, we've got quite a lot of, you know, corporate types here. It really is just a sort of the principal agent problem. It's the problem you see in companies where you need legislation to ensure that the managers and the directors act in the best interest of the owners of the firms. That doesn't mean every firm's a crook, you know, run by crooks. But we accept the fact that we have a regulatory framework to try and deal with that agency problem, right? Now, the trouble is in the case of the unions, and I, you know, look, the employer associations don't really count, Mark, I don't think, but, you know, let's have the same rules for them too, that we don't really have good legislation to deal with this agency problem. So, you know, when, you know, those guys and gals took away the union money, union dues down at the HSU, it was, you know, there's no regulatory constraint on that happening. There's nothing that basically is guaranteeing transparency and accountability. And that really is the key. I mean, I'm happy to have the debate. I mean, I actually think it would serve the unions extremely well if they were to voluntarily agree to this new regulatory environment because, you know, most union officials are perfectly honest and will be perfectly happy with being more accountable and transparent. And I think actually that legislation could end up doing the union movement a great service So instead of us sort of thinking, well, you know, you're probably all crooks, it might actually shine some disinfecting sunshine, wasn't that what Gillard talked about, on these organisations, and that could be a help. Let me just finish off by talking about the Productivity Commission inquiry. Again, you've probably all forgotten about it, but you know, this was a pledge by the Abbott team in opposition that they would bring on a Productivity Commission inquiry into really, I guess, mainly about the economic impact of industrial relations regulations, and that's currently sort of grinding through the process. So they've had a call for submissions, and submissions have been put in, and I think we'll probably get a draft report in June or July, would have to be, and with the final report towards the end of the year. I was a productivity commissioner for 12 years, so I guess I've got some insight on what's likely to happen. I think that it will be a document that economists can be happy with, but I don't think they'll overstate the case, because the trouble is that when we're thinking about economic outcomes like productivity and even firm performance, you know, the answer is always multifactorial, right? So it's sort of difficult to necessarily pin down, and I'm sure they won't have had time or the data necessary to, you know, be coming up with very strong empirical results when it comes to industrial relations. So I think what the final report is likely to do is establish a set of principles that should govern our sort of industrial relations regulatory framework in a way that it can sort of maximise economic opportunity. So will it be controversial? It could well be. I think the potential aspects for it to be controversial. And so I think it will be quite a political challenge for the government. So I think, for example, they must inevitably deal with the issue of penalty rates. I think they will deal with the issue of the unfair dismissal regulations. And I think, you know, these kinds of things, I think, unless handled well politically, can kind of create potential political damage, because, you know, you can create a fear campaign. Anyway, Gerald, you don't want me to go on too much.
Thank you, Judith.
I know more, as my students would say.
Thank you, Mark Lennon.
Well, thank you, Gerard, and thanks to you and Anne for the opportunity to speak here at the Sydney Institute tonight, and can I congratulate you on the work that the Sydney Institute does and the role it plays in the debate that we have here, not just in Sydney, but across the country. And it'd be fair to say probably that we don't agree on a lot of matters, but that's the important thing is that we can have the debate, and that's what I think has been lacking to some degree in the Australian community in recent times, that our positions have become very polarised and we haven't had genuine debates around key issues, including, of course, industrial relations reform. As always, I should start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Unions New South Wales represents about 600,000 workers across the state, and they work in all sorts of industries and do all sorts of interesting work. And we must ensure that when we talk about the issue tonight, that's industrial relations reform, when we talk about structural change, when we talk about productivity, we have to ensure that we keep thinking about those 600,000 workers and indeed the rest of the workforce across the state of New South Wales and indeed across the country. Because the debate on industrial relations and economic reform is very much an elitist one, be it business elites, be it union elites, be it politicians, be it academics. And too often we don't have the voice of the working people out there heard on these issues with great clarity. And of course, the focus on them is the whole point, because we're about ensuring, from the union perspective at the very least, that we have a growing, prosperous economy, because that's the way that we can ensure that we improve the living standards of the working people in this state and, as I say, across the country. And they're a diverse group. People think of trade unionists mainly because they're the ones that are out on the street. They still often have an image of trade unionists as construction workers with a hard hat on, or manufacturing workers in a boiler suit. But your average unionist in the modern age, in 2015, would be a female in her mid-40s who works in health, education, public administration or the retail industry. I was actually talking to a union colleague about this today and she said, that's me. So that's, and in fact, I think we're just at the stage where the number of female unionists in absolute terms is larger than the number of male unionists in the country. So that's our context of always thinking about how we're working for these people, ensuring that we've got a growing economy, but it is a growing economy that delivers equality across the nation. Now, I don't believe that we're going to have perfect equality. That is an unrealistic expectation. But we've always worked in this country on the basis that we have two endeavours, growing wealth and distributing it in a fair manner across the nation. That's been the defining value of, I think, this country, this concept of egalitarianism. I think it's one that we as a nation pride ourselves on, that we throw off sort of the elitism of the old country from where we came from, and that we've put the well-being of the working person as a benchmark, one of the benchmarks of our greatness as a nation. So it's in the context when we start talking about changes to an industrial relations system that we consider it in the context of those underlying values. And whatever happens with our industrial relations system, whatever happens with our workplaces, those values don't change. That's the important thing, that underpinning any change is the value of ensuring that we are growing an economy that is efficient but also equitable. Now, there's no doubt that our workplace has changed and it continues to change and has changed significantly over the last 30 years. If you go back as far as the 1960s, of course, the service sector, I think that Judith alluded to, the service sector employed about 50% of the workforce, and now it's about 70% of the workforce. And if you look at those industries that once commanded or were the big employers in this country, they being manufacturing, of course, agriculture, we've seen their numbers decline. And over the next 5 years, those numbers will continue to decline. Figures I've seen from the Department of Employment, the Federal Department of Employment, shows that manufacturing employment will decline by about 4% over the next 5 years, and agriculture by about 1%. But the growth industries, of course, are there. The growth industries are in areas such as health and community services. Being in my mid-50s, that's a good thing to happen. I want more health and community services, rest assured. And that's going to grow by about 16% over the next 5 years. Education will grow by 13%, and the number of people in professional and business services will grow by about 10%. And that's just over the next 5 years. What we don't know is what technology is going to do beyond that. And, of course, there's talk, as you see, that half the jobs that presently exist will be wiped out by technology by the year 2030. And of course, this whole concept of advances in technology will lead to this concept of digital disruption. It's not just the technology, but the speed at which it's occurring is ensuring that we disrupts things and establish things in ways that we can't even comprehend at the present time. But coming back to the key point, let's not be beguiled by all this, the elegance of all these systems and this technology that is coming into place. In talking about all that, in talking about changes to our economy, talking about changes to our industrial relations system, we have to still come back to the picture of what it means for the real men and women who are out there working in these industries and these new technologies and new jobs that are to come. Technology is important. The changing nature of work is important. It brings a positive for most working people. It can make work more engaging, more creative, more involved, and that's a plus, no doubt. I would say everyone in this room would have to agree that work, for most people, the changes in the nature of work in the last 30 years and moves to the service sector has made work more enjoyable for most people and more challenging for most people, but more welcoming for most people over the last 30 years. The concept of standing there in the drudgery of the factory with the routine task is long since gone, and that's a good thing. But always there are challenges with these changes, and of course one of the big challenges we hear, and Judith just alluded to it, is that, well, with this changing technology, we're out of the realm of 9 to 5, we're now in the 24/7 economy, that means therefore we don't need all the compensation we had for people that used to work odd hours and unsociable hours anymore. That's the argument that we still have. I disagree, for two reasons. First and foremost, 70% of people still work 9 to 5. The changes in that regard aren't that significant. Secondly, if you want to talk about a 24/7 economy, well, I'm happy anyone who wants to engage in a 24/7 economy, let me know. and I'll ring them up at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, I'm just about to go shopping, do you want to come and join me? Because basically, we do still regulate our hours and we have what we consider to be sociable hours and unsociable hours. So those sort of challenges and that sort of talk is very worrying for us as a union movement because what it means in the context of expectations upon working people. So what are the implications of all this for our industrial relations system? Well, I think first and foremost we have to ask ourselves whether we still do in fact have an industrial relations system. If you think about it, we don't use that term very much anymore. I don't hear many people talking about IR or having IR managers in their workplace or even having personnel managers. Now we have human resource managers. The legislation that we have in place, previous legislation, talked about workplace relations, and work choices, and now we have fair work legislation. And indeed, I'd argue that if you look at the legislation, it really is about an employment relations system. If you think about the legislation that we presently have, the focus is all on the rights of the individual, indeed the employee. The role of industrial organisations is clearly that of agent and not that of principal. It used to be, as I understand it, and I recall going back to the old conciliation and arbitration legislation. So we have a significant change, but we will have, in terms of the focus and the focus on who is the key individuals or parties in our industrial legislation. But it doesn't mean that we don't need sufficient laws and regulations into the future. Of course, you'll hear, as you've heard from the conservative side of the committee, that we need less regulation, that a dismantling of the IR system as it presently stands will assist us in enhancing the economy and economic growth and, of course, productivity. It's manifested itself, that argument from the Conservatives, in a number of the arguments that have gone before, or submissions that have already gone before the Productivity Commission. And in particular, people want to talk about reducing workplace security, they want to talk about removing penalty rates, cutting the minimum wage, and of course, increased use of individual contracts. Because we argue that this approach lacks fairness and empathy with your average worker. It assumes, of course, that workers are out there that are free economic agents and are able to go into the workplace and negotiate on their own behalf. We don't think that is indeed the case. But perhaps there's another argument too here that is certainly gaining weight around the nation and, of course, around the developed world. And that goes to the issue about it's not just about cutting regulation. It's an argument that it's economically irresponsible in the present environment to be seeking to reduce wages and conditions. We've seen with the data, and you've heard, and Judith alluded to it, about the fact that wages growth is at its lowest in 20 or 30 years. We are seeing actually real wages, I think, in the last few figures start to decline. Wages grew by just 2.3% in the year to March this year. That's the smallest it's been since 1998 when the ABS series began. And around the world, in the developed world, we've seen the gap between profits and wages grow wider over the last 20 or 30 years. Everywhere you look, everyone is talking about growing inequality. Books have been written about it. The Economist is talking about it. The Economist magazine is talking about it. Obama is talking about it. The OECD is talking about it. The IMF is talking about it. This is not a creation, the concept of growing inequality in the developed world. This is not a creation of the union movement or indeed the political left. It is a serious issue of concern for all who are concerned about growing economies. And it comes back to a fundamental question in ensuring that we have an opportunity for economies to grow by ensuring there is demand in the economy, that is, there are workers and working people with money in their pockets to spend. And that's what's at the heart of the debate as it presently stands. Interesting concept in terms of how we can fix that problem is that the two aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. There's this concept that we can, of course, have growing economies whilst reducing inequality at the same time. The OECD, back in one of its papers in 2012, called Economic Policy Forums, it's an annual paper puts out, in Chapter 5 of that paper, it talked about how we can have economic growth whilst reducing inequality at the same time. And it talks about ensuring that you have things in a country such as a higher minimum wage, that you have strong collective bargaining rights, that you have protections for temporary and casual employees, that of course you have a good tax and transfer system, and of course you have a strong education system, amongst other things. It's important in all of that, of course, in the context of discussion about industrial relations, that it does point to the fact that one of the key things is collective bargaining, ensuring that employees have access to collective bargaining and strong collective bargaining rights. Of course, we'd also argue here in New South Wales, and one area of agreement that I can assure you Judith and I can agree on is that I believe that the state systems, industrial relations systems, should never have been dismantled. I'm a strong states writer, particularly when it comes to the system in New South Wales. I can see Mark Patterson shaking his head, but he's been doing that for 30 years. Of course, we believe also that the Fair Work Commission should be empowered with general arbitration rights as well. The danger we've got at the present time, and this is where our industrial system has to be at its best, we will have, and it's again an issue, goes to the issue of inequality, and it goes to the issue of a growing disparity amongst the working people in this state, in this country, I'm sorry. We will have people that are able to access, through education, those good quality jobs that will ensure that they can be take their full role in society. They need industrial regulation, they need support. But then, of course, we'll have a second group, those people who aren't the less skilled, those people who are on the margins, who need to ensure that they've got particular industrial protections. A case in point, you saw a few weeks ago, that's a story on Four Points about the workers who are on 420 visas that were being short-term work visas here who have been exploited in the horticultural and food industry. That's the case in point. That's the need to ensure that we continue to need strong industrial regulation. Another area which gives rise to the concerns about why we need to maintain our strong industrial relations system, employment relations system, call it what you like, is interns. Now, there, when I was growing up, interns were something that appeared in a hospital and worked as doctors. They were doctors that did all the work and then eventually became GPs or went on to become specialists. But now we have this growing phenomenon of basically university students who leave university, looking for a job, and then they're offered a position, not a job, as an intern for 3-6 months. Largely unregulated, an area of increasing concern and a sign of what's happening in the brave new world of our world of social media and the new world of digital technology. It seems that even though we've got these changes, the same issues keep coming back. And anyone who would tell you that, that's fair, they should go and do a bit of an internship, a bit of vocational training, etc., you've got to be very cautious in regards to those sorts of matters, because indeed they often end up being unpaid work. So in conclusion, there's a lot of consequences of changes that are happening in the nature of work at the present time. What we want to ensure is that we still have an industrial relations system, an employment relations system, that is well regulated. Doesn't mean the regulation shouldn't change to make sure that we match the changing nature of the workforce. But at the heart of it, we've got to ensure that we've got a few key things. Importantly, we believe that there has to be scope to cover all those who are in a working relationship. Secondly, it can be flexible enough that when you need flexibility, it should be done through the vehicle of collective bargaining. We should acknowledge that I think there should be an enhanced role for the Fair Work Commission. And finally, of course, it should ensure, as always, as it has done for the last 100 years, our industrial relations system, that we're trying to reach those twin growth goals of enhancing growth and removing inequality in our community. Of course, to finish on a positive note, we'd always ensure that there would be, our laws encourage a greater spirit of cooperation. For when industrial relations are bad, when employment relations are bad, it's bad for productivity, it's bad for morale, and it's bad for both working people and their employer. I think our industrial relations system and our employment practices have served us well over the last 30 years in particular, and I think that they will continue to serve us well, with a little tweaking here and there, into the 21st century and meet the challenges we need to do so as a nation. Thanks very much.
Well, thanks to Judith Sloan and Mark Lennon. We've got to the top of the hour, so a lot of people here, and I've asked you to keep your comment or your question brief and direct it to whoever you want to direct it to. Thanks also again to the Gallipoli Club for providing this facility tonight. I'll get you both back up here, one on either side, then I'll disappear shortly. Just on the concept of competition, which is not often spoken about in the union movement these days, I mean, as you would know, if I want to set up a rival to the CFMEU or to the Health Services Union, I can't do it because I wouldn't have coverage. In other words, the union movement and also the employer organisations now are about one of the few areas of society in which competition is banned. Would it make sense to open up the union movement and, well, employer organisations and union organisations to competition from within? Yes or no? Let's start with Mark and then with Judith and then we'll go on. Okay.
Well, clearly, I would argue, no, I don't think there's a necessity to do so, but I must say this, that it already, as I say, if you go back to the Fair Work legislation, for instance, where the focus is on the employee, that you have the right, for instance, when it comes to collective bargaining, for each employee to appoint their own bargaining agent. Now, usually, if the union is there, then by default, the union is the bargaining agent, but the interesting one when the railways, New South Wales Railways, 3 or 4 years ago, advised all their members, the union members, whether they were happy for the union to be their bargaining agent. 17 people responded no, they wanted their own bargaining agent, and they nominated different people, including one person who nominated their parish priest. Not sure what happened in the end there. But also understand this, that at the present time there is a lot of competition out there already in terms of employment advice. One of the things, and I think Judith alludes to this, is the Fair Work Ombudsman. It's far more resourced, etc., in that regard. I heard, and this is the challenge of the digital times, I heard a young woman on the radio the other day. She was an apprentice in a male-dominated industry. She's been interviewed on ABC Radio about her experiences, and she was asked, so do you feel a bit intimidated working in an all-male industry or an all-male workplace, etc.? She said, no, no. She said, myself and other female apprentices across the state, we've got a Facebook site together, and we exchange information there about wages and conditions and what's happening. So there's all sorts of forms of competition, I think, already out there in terms of people seeking advice and forms of industrial representation as it stands.
I think it's a very good question, Gerald, and yes, I would be in favour of greater competition. It's one of those things. So you think about if you're a shareholder of a company and you really don't like how it's going, well, you know, you sell your shares and you go and buy shares in another company, right? Whereas if you're in, I mean, you say there's choice, but there's very restricted choice. So you were a hospital orderly and you're a member of the HSU, and you got a sort of whiff of the misbehaviour of HSU officials, your choice essentially was to stay with that one monopoly union or to resign. Okay, there was no other choice. And I think what we have to understand is that the bad behaviour of unions is partly because of that lack of competition. If there had been greater transparency, accountability and competition, my guess is that the HSU officials would never have behaved the way they did, because, you know, once that got out, people would go heading off in the direction of alternative representation. I mean, I take your point about there being competition for employment advice, and I actually think you make a good point about the Fair Work Ombudsman, because if you look at how the system of compulsory arbitration was traditionally conceived, the trade unions were the enforcers, right? And, you know, that was how it was set up. They only ever enforce it really well in respect of larger firms. And so there was a massive degree of non-compliance in the system, which is, I think, partly why it didn't actually completely grind to a halt. But now you've got this incredibly well-resourced Fair Work Ombudsman with all these sort of, you know, eager and perhaps zealous young graduates working there, and so they've become the employment mechanism, the enforcement mechanism, and up to a point it actually is, I think, undercut the role of the unions.
Okay, now there's a question down there.
Thanks, Brad. This is mostly directed to Mark. On the weekend I was at a political conference. We had Mr. Alan Tyrrell from Hope Winery plead to us to try and make some changes about penalty rates. He gave the example of not being able to pick on a particular day due to weather, whether that forced him to want to pick, lost a whole crop because of the penalty breaks made it not affordable to use the grain nomads and backpackers who were very keen to actually work that down.
Okay, so a question about penalty rates and the restrictions they impose. Yep. Mark.
Well, I think the debate about penalty rates has, you know, been exhausted over a long time. The fact is that penalty rates make, if you look at the industries where penalty rates prevail, they make up a substantial part of people's overall take-home pay. And I think the community at large still supports the fact that if people are working unsociable hours, then they should be compensated. And that's the whole concept behind the issue of penalty rates. It was interesting over the Easter weekend where there was a vigorous campaign being launched by the employer organisations to put up stickers saying, sorry, but we're closed because of penalty rates, etc. It didn't really get a huge amount of public support. Indeed, most of the stuff that we saw...
victimised the employers.
Oh, hang on. Okay.
It didn't get a lot of public support because most of the stuff that we saw on social media was in support of penalty rates. I don't know the particular circumstances with the winery, and I can't go to that particular circumstance, but it seems to me that if employers know at certain times during the year that they have to pay penalty rates, they need to factor that into their overall costs.
And do you want to make a brief response? Then we go to Denise.
I mean, the thing is, you know, we're not Robinson Crusoe here. You know, like, the world of work has changed overseas. You know, the nature of the workforce has changed overseas, and they survive extremely well with our penalty rates. You know, the thing is, we know that there are from time to time, there are times of the week where employers will have to provide what we call the supply price in order to induce, encourage workers to work at certain times and particular kind of workers to work at certain times. But to have some top-down fixed arrangement, that just will clash with the supply and demand situation. And so basically what you get is you get a serious degree of economic suboptimality. You get businesses not being created because the business model will never work with this top-down penalty rate. So, you know, get with the modern world, Mark. I mean, if you go overseas and you look at what happens, sure, there are penalty rates in some parts. Well, you might laugh. But you don't think overseas experience is relevant?
I look at the US and America and see what workers are doing.
You go to Europe, you go to the UK, they do not have the penalty rate structure. You go to France, they can't believe it, okay? You know, so we have to think about this. Well, you know...
Judith, don't ask the audience because they'll reply. And then I'll lose control.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think the union campaign against those employers was a disgrace because you talk about open debate and you wanted to shut down open debate.
Okay, now I think we'll pick this up later. Okay, Dimitri. Mark, come back here. Yes.
Thank you.
Who's this to?
Both of them.
Both of them. Okay.
Thank you both for your presentation. My observation is that the industrial relations framework we have is geared towards the working, not surprisingly, but often or increasingly to the expense of the not working. And I give the example of the minimum wage, where the minimum wage is, correct me if I'm wrong, of the order of $650 a week, whereas the single unemployment benefit is $250 a week. That's a pretty big gap. So somebody who's a long-term unemployed is essentially barred from getting a job in many cases. Do you want to make a comment on that?
The suggestion is the minimum wage is too high in the sense that it discriminates against certain workers who can't get, or potential workers who can't get jobs. Right. Judith.
Well, you know, and of course you're right, and I think, you know, the irony is that this is not widely acknowledged. Why do government interventions typically take the form of providing wage subsidies for people who've been unemployed for a long time and find it difficult to get a job? Because the regulated wage is too high to encourage employers to take them on, you know. So in a sense, that's, you know, you actually have a government acknowledgement, including Labor governments, acknowledging that the fact that wages are too high, and too high, you know, we know that people would accept lower rates of pay, but they are legally bound, where they're legally excluded from that arrangement happening. So, you know, that's when I was talking about unemployment. The thing that worries me is that if you kind of drill down, you're now getting quite high rates of youth unemployment. And then if you drill down a bit further, you look at who are the young unemployed people. They are people who may have had, you know, patchy education records and the like may have not got off to a good start in the labour force. And basically, the regulation excludes them from getting a foothold in the door. And the research is very clear. You can start in a casual job, a low-paid casual job. If you can get on that escalator, you have a really good chance of making it. But if you don't get on that escalator in the first place, you often stay in real trouble.
Mark, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, can I first apologise to the gentleman down here about that? I should have declared an interest in the question of penalty rates, aside from the fact that I'm a union official, I have three teenage children, so it's very interesting. I've got a vested interest in making sure they get penalty rates on weekends.
I've got children too, and I do too.
So just coming back to the issue of the minimum wage, I mean, that's been an argument again for many years about whether it is actually leaving people out of employment opportunities, and I read the Institute of Public Affairs submission to the Fair Work Commission's wage case last year. I read it before I came here because I knew the minimum wage come up. And despite all the argument that you go through, it's still very questionable whether it is having an impact on employment levels. That's the question. Every other country around the world at the moment is arguing about raising its minimum wage for the very reasons I was talking about, is we need to make sure people have got money to spend. We need to make sure there's demand in the economy. And yet we seem to want to continue to have this argument about reducing our minimum wage. If you want to talk about fairness and equity, then having a decent minimum wage is part of any society that is fair and equitable. You look at the US Congress did a paper earlier this year on their arguments about raising the minimum wage to $10.10. And yes, they said that it would raise, I think, 16 million people who are on a low wage out of poverty. There would be an impact, a slight impact on employment levels, but the main thing would be that the people would be lifted out of poverty. And I think that's an argument in favour of a high minimum wage.
Question here?
Yeah. My question is about geographic flexibility. And for example, Sydney, we've got congestion issues, we've got high property price values, and yet I believe the system doesn't really reward people for setting up employment for regional centres where you have neither of those. Because it's fairly inflexible as far as wages are concerned for a certain kind of work. Is that a fair comment or not?
Well, that was one of the arguments for keeping the state systems. Actually, by the way, Mark, one of the reasons they wanted to get rid of the state systems was that the New South Wales one was always so appalling that they were prepared to do anything to get rid of the New South Wales system. The others weren't so bad.
The government?
The government.
The Howard government.
The Howard government was very keen to get rid of the New South Wales system. Mark, you know that. You don't expect wages to be the same in South Australia as you do in New South Wales. You don't expect the wages in Port Augusta to be the same as they are in Bondi. You know, and the thing is, our system, has some flexibility above the minimums, but it doesn't have the flexibility that it used to have in terms of actually regulated wages, which were different across the states. And interestingly enough, as I recall, there were some states which actually had regional wages as well as CBD wages. I think it was that Queensland had that. It's a very regional place, of course, Queensland. So we definitely lost a lot of flexibility with that.
Mark?
Well, I think we've sort of agreed on one issue there about the state systems, and I take the fact that the Howard government wanting to get rid of the New South Wales system, I take that as a compliment. Clearly, we, the union member in New South Wales, were too good.
Question here?
Yes.
Linda White from Web Channel. Judith, you mentioned that there might be some controversial findings in the Productivity Commission review. This is a speculation, but do you think that it will become another Henry review and nothing will happen, or do you think they just need the permission to do something?
So it's about the Productivity Review. Yep.
I think one of the interesting issues is that there's sort of... you talk about the changing nature of the workforce, but then, the unions are very supportive of collective bargaining. Whereas, in fact, to me, the way this must go is in the direction of individual contracting. You know, we don't have big manufacturing operations with great slews of undifferentiated jobs. That all kind of made a bit of sense, right? We now have these sort of agile... technology disrupted service industries where actually we're wanting to get individuals, to be individuals and stuff. So I think there's a really big sort of philosophical clash at the moment that I don't actually see in 20 years' time there being much for a role of collective bargaining, because, you know, we're not interested in sort of undifferentiated leave your brains at the gate kind of jobs anyway. So will they produce any controversial recommendations? I think they will, in the sense that you know, they are likely to point to the economic damage of the system, and that I think is politically difficult for the government. And I would imagine that they may in fact make some recommendations. For example, Australia's minimum wage is extremely high by international standards. What is it about Australia that would justify that? You know, I think they're likely to say something about the unfair dismissal laws. We have extremely strong employment protection laws. And I think they may well indeed focus on that inequality issue, because the thing is, these regulations do a tremendous amount of harm for the people who are not just in employment, but who are trying to get an employment because their, you know, productive capabilities are not great, and therefore the system is very harmful to them.
Mark, do you want to make a response?
Yeah, no doubt the sort of things that that Judith alluded to, if that's what comes out of the Productivity Commission, that will be a major concern. I mean, for the average person out there, when we talk about employment relations, and this was evident during the work choices period, we as the insiders can talk about all the different aspects of it, and, pardon me, the different provisions. But at the heart of it, if people think that there's going to be changes that are going to affect their job security and their income security, then they will resist that. And if you looked at work choices, the key things there were the removal of unfair dismissal laws for anyone working for an employer with less than 100 employees, and of course the right, pardon me, I've been shouting at the children on the weekend, my apologies, the right of the fact that an employer could move you onto an individual contract and reduce your conditions. They were the key elements that people understood, and that's why work choices were rejected by the community. And if the Productivity Commission comes out with something similar, then there's a major problem.
Okay, now we've got a lot of people here, but there's a question here. We've got to be very brief. Yes.
Top view on this for the economy was improving productivity, so I understood what you were saying. On the other hand, there's a great divide. Mark mentioned at all anything about improving productivity. He was talking about inequality and various other things.
All right, so the question is, you were talking about productivity, Mark was talking about inequality. Okay, brief responses.
Well, I mean, to give Mark his due, I don't think he was entirely talking about inequality, because you were compared with some of your more troglodytic colleagues, you're actually talking about the importance of increasing economic wealth and prosperity. You know, so I think the productivity story is very complicated. I'm kind of like mesmerised by the macro figures. It goes back to my point. We've got to think of this at the micro level, the workplace. How do we establish, you know, fair, acceptable terms of conditions for employees, which they find attractive to accept jobs and work hard, while at the same time is creating good business models which underpin investment. You know, that really is the challenge, and you don't get there by a one-size-fits-all Fair Work Commission sitting in a posh building in Exhibition Street in Melbourne.
Can I make a brief comment, Mark?
Well, absolutely. Productivity is vitally important. The reason that I didn't mention in the context of talking about industrial relations reform is yet I'm yet to see exactly how it fits into that particular model, that productivity is about increasing education, increasing skills level. It's about capital deepening. They're the things that are going to enhance productivity in the country. It's about better infrastructure. All those things will enhance productivity. But I've yet to see, and I remember John Howard being asked on Four Corners during the work choices debate. He was interviewed about work choices. They did a whole story on it. And he was asked that very question. How are these changes going to enhance productivity? And he couldn't answer it.
Question
here. Yeah, just very quickly. I was wondering about the role of self-interest as a person who works as a nurse. And looking around here, there's a few people who will probably be requiring a bedpan at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Can we get on with the question?
Yeah, the role of self-interest and penalty rates.
There's a question about the role of self-interest and penalty rates. I think we've covered it, but at any rate, you want us to respond?
Well, you know, as I said, you know, obviously an employer is going to have to offer the supply price if you want to. And you know, actually, interesting enough, in the case of nurses in particular, you know, they are covered by enterprise bargaining, so that's not actually in the award system. And with a professional group like that, and I go overseas, you will see penalty rates for those kinds of occupations. What you don't see is in the kind of hospitality industry, in the tourism industry, where the jobs are, well, you know, they're relatively unskilled or require relatively quick on-the-job training. So, you know, this is part of the trouble that we've kind of, we have this, what I'd say was really a conflation of ideas between occupations where you will need to have high supply prices at non-standard hours, and lots where you don't.
Mark? Well, of course, we can always do comparisons with overseas. You know, if we want to adopt something from France, I'd be happy to do that. In particular, industry-wide bargaining is something that is unique to France. They only have...
Really well, the economy...
It's going to try. Well, that's the very point. So there's a very point about here is that, yes, there may be different conditions in different countries, but that doesn't warrant the fact that they should be important in Australia, or indeed that their economy is performing particularly well.
And we're getting very close to the end. There's a question right down the back. Yes.
Yes, there is.
Okay, Dennis. Okay, go.
Questions about the contribution of the trade union. You know, the government's looking at trying to price university access much higher for students, and we're looking at competing the globalised world as opposed to the skill IPO line. So the OECD's been quite big with the
example. It's hard to hear it up here. There's a question about the importance of training. Okay.
Well, look, you know, I'm sure education is part of the story, but, I mean, the thing is we've been investing much more seriously in education over very long periods of time, and actually productivity's fallen in a hole. You know, the productivity was operating at about 2.5% in the 90s, and it's now lucky if it's 2. So, you know, I mean, I feel a little conflicted having spent a lot of my time in higher education, but I think the idea that just spending more taxpayers' money on higher education and training is going to lift our economic performance is probably not true.
Mark?
I no doubt education is all, and I think if we have to focus on an area where we are giving greater access and ensuring that everyone is getting the opportunity, it's got to be education. And we're concerned at the present time about changes to the TAFE system and how people can access that and through private providers, because clearly, and this has been across the political divide, have introduced this system. If you have a look in Victoria in particular, but also what's happening here in New South Wales, what we're seeing is more private providers in the system that aren't delivering the sort of training we need, and that is a major concern.
There's a question here. Professor
Sloan, how optimistic are you that the present coalition leadership will be minded to
So it's a political question, will the Abbott government likely to take reform forward?
No. But, I mean, the thing is there are a couple of important reforms on the table at the moment. So we need to get the re-establishment of the ABCC, the Australian Building Construction Commission. I cannot believe that the Senate has blocked that. So we need to get that. You know, the building industry, CBD, you know, big infrastructure, way too expensive, you know, lawlessness amongst the union and the like. So that would be a tick. And the other one to get up is the Registered Organisations Commission, which brings in a kind of semi-corporate regulatory environment for unions and employer associations to get that accountability and transparency. So, you know, I'd be watching that. I guess what they'll do with these other ones, but, you know, like they're weak. You know, they've been burned, will be to take other changes to the election. And that's probably fair enough, by the way.
There's a question down the back, yeah.
Is there any validity in the thesis that Australia is going to have to cope with Indonesia in particular in the next 20 years as a sleeping economic giant, and that regulation superimposed is a constraining influence on making adjustments that are going to have to be necessary if Australia
can
compete?
The question is that the emergence of Indonesia, will we have to become more competitive than otherwise would be the case? Well, let's start with Mark.
Yep.
I'm sure there will be there'll always be challenges from other countries in terms of competitiveness. In the last 10 years, it's of course been China, and we seem to have dealt with that extremely well. Sure, with some changes to industrial relations that have happened over the last 10 or 15 years, but I don't think that's going to warrant significant change to our industrial relations system.
Well, I mean, I think the whole issue of the increasing globalisation competitiveness is important. And the thing is, that's why, if you've done an economics degree, the demand argument doesn't wash, because the idea that you put up wages in order to increase demand, that might work if you've got a closed economy, but it completely falls apart when you've got an open economy. What we need to be thinking about is how competitive our unit labour costs are and how we compete. I mean, we don't just want an economy where the only activity is the kind of activity that has to be here, like, you know, the bedpan and cutting your hair and stuff, because, you know, so many things are now globalised or globalisable. So we really have to think about being internationally competitive and extremely productive too.
Just a quick response on a final proposition. We'll start with Judith and end with Mark. Unions have never had fewer numbers, but unions are probably as significant in the economy as they had ever been, due to the fact that the awards they negotiate cover a significant number of workers. So to what extent does declining union numbers have an impact on union influence?
Look, I think that's a really good question. So it's really about the disjunction between the degree of unionisation, which I pointed out was low, and their influence. And the thing is, you know, they have a model where their influence is not dependent on the number of the proportion of workers who belong to them. They run through the regulatory system, through the Fair Work Commission, and through public policy more generally, particularly at the state government level. So, you know, you become anti-privatisation, you impose ratios in the hospitals, you have certain rules in respect of education. So I think it's a really interesting point. So that disjunction between how many people are bothering to actually join up to unions, but the influence that they can actually impose through these other means, and the Fair Work Commission is one of those means.
Mark, tell us how important you are.
Well, let me just say this, that if this was a room of members and we were having a discussion about the latest proposed changes to some workplace, let me tell you, I would be told very clearly by the members that we're not having enough influence. That's not the perception out there, that there has been fundamental change in this country over the last 30 years, which has been necessary, don't get me wrong, but people think, as a consequence, average working people, not just unionists, that they are under more pressure, more stress as a consequence, and all the power out there in the community and in the workplace rests with the employers. Now, that mightn't be the case, we can argue about that, but that is certainly the perception. And can I just say this in terms of declining union numbers? It's not just unions, it's institutions generally. We are no longer joining institutions. Right? Church attendances are down. You know, 45% of the 1960s, 17% now. Service clubs are struggling. Rotary clubs are struggling. You look around, Generation X, Generation Y, whatever they're called, Generation Z, don't join institutions. They don't trust them. They don't see the need for them. They will join and come together as a collective over issues, certain issues it may be. We can have a rally out the front about penalty rates. They'll come and join that. We might have one the next day about minimum wages. They mightn't come and join that. They'll come around environmental issues, but they will not join an institution as such. And that's a challenge for us all.
We could go on, but we don't, and it's right on 7 o'clock, so we're going to finish. And look, I'll just be very brief. A lot of people here, and we're right on time. I think we've had a very informative and lively discussion tonight with Judith Sloan and Mark Lennon, both stating their cases in a very considered, reasonable and intelligent way, as you would expect from both of them. So we're very pleased to put this on tonight. The papers will be published in due course. 648 is here, and the podcast will be up tomorrow. And for tonight, thank you and well done, Judith. And thank you and well done. Mark wants to say one nice thing. If it's nice, you can say it.
I just withdraw my statement about shouting at the children. I was shouting at children over the weekend, but that's from a rugby referee. I was shouting at 30 of them.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.